Welcome back to the American Revolution podcast, episode 77, The Siege of Fort Stanwyck. So when last time we talked, we were covering the Battle of Oriskany. Now, as far as battles go, this is definitely one of the most violent and bloody affairs that will take place in the entirety of the frontier, especially in New York during the American Revolution. And the last episode was rather long because there was a large gap in between podcast episodes, so I wanted to cover the beginning of the Mohawk campaign and the battle itself. Now we have to look at the siege of Fort Stanwyck, which is also another expansive topic to talk about, because a lot goes on in just a little bit of time. You see, St. Leger achieved his goal of keeping Herkimer's men from arriving at the fort, but he does not totally destroy the force. In fact, a small portion is saved thanks to Herkimer, and they're able to, bring themselves back to Fort Dayton. They're battered, they're beat up, but it definitely wasn't the knockout punch that St. Leger was looking for. So he has to resort to other tactics, but we're going to get to that. When we had talked about the Battle of Oriskany, Herkimer had sent a runner ahead and said, "Hey, when we're getting close, when you get this message to Gainsford, I want you to fire a cannon shot, and I want, if we're close, we'll answer back and we'll sortie out to, send a sortie out to help us out, because I know that we're gonna run into some issues with St. Leger and his Indians." Well, the message does get to Gainsford, but the cannon shots were probably unheard because by that point, the Indians and Loyalists had already sprung their trap. So at this point, the cannon shots become white noise. They're just, washed out in the background. Gainsroot sent Lieutenant Colonel Willett with 250 men and a cannon to sortie because they could probably hear the intense fight that's going on, or at least they got word that there was an intense fight happening. But Willett never gets there. See, principal British force was working on the siege, and then they had to clear roads because Gainsroot blocked up the roads so that they couldn't bring up bigger guns. So the camps are, for the most part, unguarded, especially the Indian camp, because Johnson. I'm sorry, I almost forgot his name for a second, but Sir John Johnson, there we go, I could spit it out, and Joseph Brant were off with the entirety of the Indian force, about 1,000 guys, fighting with Herkimer at Oriskany. So there's no one in the camp. The women were most likely chased off. I don't know that any harm came to the women because, we're subject to who tells the story, and that's the victors of history. So, as far as everything I've read, I don't know that any harm came to the women. I'm assuming not, because they probably just ran off into the woods. The other thing, too, is Willett has 250 guys. He's going to carry every bit of supplies that he can. He knows a siege is coming. He's going to get everything that he can as far as food, supplies and powder, weapons, whatever they have there. Just grab it all. Get it out of there. And that's what they do. Well, this is big for two reasons. One, it deprives the British and the Indians of those supplies, and it reinforces, whatever supplies they were lacking in the fort. The other thing too is it's going to eventually lead to the Indians just leaving. They're going to abandon the siege because if St. Leger can't protect their camp while they're off fighting for him, what the heck's good fighting for him? Because obviously, he doesn't care what happens to the Indians. So they leave, or they will leave. In the raid itself, they actually steal the correspondence and five flags from Sir John Johnson's tent. They go so far as to thumb their noses at the leader of the Indian coalition by raising those flags over the fort under the Continental flag. So that was actually a fun little anecdote. They took these five flags and they raised them above the fort, John Johnson comes back, looks up and says, and sees his flags hanging there, and he's just dumbfounded as to what happened while he was gone. With his men, when St. Leger gets those men back from trying to stop Willett from raiding the camp, he now prepares himself for a principal siege. He knows that there's no reinforcement coming. But he also knows that he's going to have to lay siege to this fort because it doesn't look like they're coming out. So he sends a few men to go have a discussion with the defenders of the fort. You know, St. Leger is on a time schedule because he has to get to Albany to meet up with Burgoyne, and he needs to do that as fast as possible. So if he can get the fort to capitulate, well, that'll just save him a whole lot of time and effort. So he sends, the next day, he sends Colonel Butler, Major Ancron, and another officer to the fort. They arrive under the flag of truce, and these officers were sent there to deliver a message from St. Leger. Now, they were met by Gainsborough, the commander of the fort, and Willett, the second-in-command, and any other officer they could cram into this tiny little meeting room inside the fort. Now, I've been inside Fort Stanwyck. It is a fabulous reconstruction of the fort that was there 200 years ago. They did a really good job. The funny thing about it is it's this fort sitting in the middle of the city of Rome, New York. So, you know, it's a smaller city in upstate New York, and you just, you know, drive down Main Street and all of a sudden you come up on this fort. It's you know, just sitting in the middle of town. So it is a kind of an interesting sight to see. But the National Park Service does a fantastic job of, protecting the property, and you know, they did a really good job building this. You can actually go into there's a room or a building, I guess, in the fort. It's a small build. They're all small buildings, but it's a small building that you walk in and the lights turn on, and you look down into a ditch and you see just bricks. And what that is that's the original foundation for the fort that was there 250 years earlier. It's quite a sight to see. It's really cool because it's, you know, you realize you're standing on top of this archaeological site. It's the last remaining bits that they could find when they did the original archaeological dig, and they figured that's pretty much where, the exact placement of the fort was when they built the reconstructed model. But I'm sorry, I digress from the story. So we're in this tiny little room. We have a bunch of American officers and three British officers, and they deliver the message from St. Leger. It simply said that if they would surrender, they could leave with their property, their families, their lives, and just go off on their merry. That's pretty standard operating procedure. You see, in the American Revolution, it's a more of a gentlemanly affair. You don't have these total war, or these stiff terms of surrender that you would see from even as soon as the American Civil War, where you have, you know, a big personality like Grant saying, no, I'm not taking anything other than the complete and utter surrender of your army. And if you don't want to complete surrender of the army, well, guess what? We can continue this fighting until I just drain you of as many men possible. And, you know, honestly, I don't care how many men die from my side. I have so many more resources than you do. You know, that attitude doesn't play out in the American Revolution because neither side had the resources to play total war. So they need to conserve every man possible. But this is where St. Leger is interesting, because normally they would say, well, you can leave and go off on your merry way. We don't bother you. You're fine. If you don't, you know, we're going to lay siege to the fort. We're going to, you know, cannon it, mortar it. We're going to do whatever we can to get inside this fort, but we will force you to capitulate. St. Leger, on the other hand, is like, no, I'm going to use threats and scare tactics on these guys. See, he says that if they don't surrender, then he's going to take the fort and he's going to do it over their dead bodies. Oh, and by the way, as they continue down the Mohawk, he doesn't think he's going to be able to hold off his Indian allies and their thirst for blood. They're gonna take it out on the population. And it's going to be revenge for everything that's happened at Fort Stanwyck. And so the American officers look, and Willett is the man to respond. And he simply says, "Do I understand you, sir? I think you say you come from a British colonel who is the commander of the army that invests this fort. And by your uniform, you appear to be an officer in the British service. You come from a British colonel to the commandant of this garrison and tell him that if he does not deliver this fort, your commander will send his Indians to murder our women and children." Obviously, they see this as an idle threat, or they think that, you know, St. Leger can't deliver on his promise to annihilate the people of the valley. So they say, "Nope, see you later." Excuse me. They say, "No, we'll see you later." So St. Leger is forced to begin the siege. He first begins to build redoubts, but he's got to move closer to the fort because he needs to get his batteries in position to actually do any kind of damage, or if they're going to do any kind of damage. Remember, he only has 2 6-pound cannons and 2 3-pound cannons. And then on top of that, he has 4 Cohorn mortars, which are very small. These are going to do nothing to this sod-covered fort. I mean, it's got thick timber walls, sod cover roofs. No matter what you do, it's got earthen backing. Whatever happens, you're just gonna, even if you got through the timber, you're gonna hit dirt. And cannons are pretty ineffective on earthen defenses. There's nothing you can do. It's solid. It's denser than the lead ball flying into it. So obviously, this is a problem for St. Leger. He doesn't have the guns. They left thinking that this fort was going to be a dilapidated fort with 60 men in it. At one point, this was actually kind of interesting. I found this out from a ranger friend. St. Leger takes one of his Cohorn mortars and puts it on a gun carriage. He's going to try and make an impromptu howitzer. Now, I remember we did talk about artillery a while back, and you know the difference between a cannon and a howitzer and a mortar is the trajectory of the flight pattern. You see, a cannon sends a cannonball on a rather linear trajectory over great distance, where the mortar has a high arcing trajectory, but it doesn't have a lot of distance on it. You got to be in a little bit closer. However, the howitzer can do a high arcing trajectory over a farther distance, so it's like the best of both worlds. But the problem is, the Cohorn mortar still doesn't have enough power to do that high arcing shot or even send a large enough projectile into the fort to do any real damage. So he's stuck with what he has. So St. Leger needs to switch tactics. So he begins to build parallel trenches that will eventually lead up to the fort, and then he's going to undermine the walls, where he just digs underneath the walls, puts some gunpowder in there or something, and blows the wall up. And then now, look at that, you got a hole in the wall. Now I can drive into that hole in the wall. But while all of this is going on, Willett and another man are going to take on a task that is probably the most dangerous for the entire siege. Now, Herkimer's force is gone. They've been either killed or they've been sent retreating back to Fort Dayton. So there's no help coming from Fort Dayton. They need to get word out that they need help. So the mission is to get to Fort Dayton and then from there get word out to the county militias and try and draw in as many people as they can to come and relieve the fort. While all this is going on, the Indians leave. They're not there to lay siege to the fort. They say see you later. So the battle for Oriskany happens in the fourth. it is probably about a week later, a little less than a week later, that Will is going to make this attempted breakout. And he does. It's successful. He gets out with another man, under the cover of darkness. They're able to get through the woods, the swamps, and the Union territory, and they arrive at Fort Dayton about 2 days later. The estimated date of their arrival is somewhere around August 12th. They're seeking help, but they find out that help is already on the way. It's coming in the form of continental support. You see, Schuyler learned about the siege, and he learned about the Battle of Oriskany, and he calls a council of war. And he proposes sending a force to relieve the garrison. Now, the commander's with him. Now, remember, Schuyler, this is this weird flux time, and I know that I'm trying to follow the timeline of things, but there's these weird gaps where we talk about, oh, this person is in charge, but, you know, whatever. Up until Gates takes overall command of the army a few weeks later, Schuyler is still in command, even though there was other guys at Valcour Island and the loss of Ticonderoga and all of that. Schuyler was still overall commander of the Army of the Northern Department. He, for medical, his poor medical health, was in Albany because he couldn't be out on campaign as regularly as he would have liked. He had too many ailments. So Schuyler, in the middle of August, is still technically the commander of the Army of the Northern Department. So he is going to be the one to say, call a council of war and say, we need to talk about sending a relief force. Now, the commanders thought that this would weaken the army, and they start to bicker back and forth because they still have Burgoyne to contend with. He is gaining some momentum. You know, Bennington is still fresh, but, you know, they lost it. Well, they got pushed back at Hubbardton, Fort Anne, Fort Edward, like, you know, all these forts along, you know, coming down, they lose them. So what are they going to do? They have, you know, 4,000, you know, or so rank and file. At this point, they're going to weaken the army more by sending men up the Mohawk. This doesn't seem like a really good idea. So this bickering goes back and forth for a while. And finally, Schuyler has had enough, and he says, "Gentlemen, I shall take the responsibility myself. Fort Stanwyck and the Mohawk Valley shall be saved. Where is the brigadier who will command the relief? I shall beat up 4 volunteers tomorrow." Now, I'm going to give you guys a moment to try and guess what brigadier is going to be the first man to step up and say, "I'll do it." Okay, now that we've taken some time to think about it, if you were going to say Benedict Arnold, well, you'd be 100% right. The man is always looking for a fight. Now, in the next episode, we're going to talk about a couple of events that happened before and during this whole Fort Stanwyck affair. So I want you to follow along. It's hard to follow ranks with certain people because they're not standardized yet. You know, they could say, "Oh, we're going to brevet you this rank," and then it takes like forever before it becomes official. Or, you know, some documents say, you know, some documents talking about specific events will say, you know, such and such was this rank, while other documents will say such and such is this rank. And I think this is what happens. I think Benedict Arnold is technically a major general at this point, but I'm not 100% sure. It's something that we're going to talk about in the next episode, but it's very confusing. The only thing that you need to know is that Benedict Arnold is going to be at the head of 950 men, along with his second-in-command, Brigadier General Ebenezer Leonard, a man from Massachusetts. So let's look at the timeline. August 4, Battle of Oriskany, all this stuff happens. Now, about a week later, Willett gets to Fort Dayton on or around the 12th. It'll take another just about a week and a half for Ben Darnold to arrive, and he arrives on the 21st. There he meets 100 more county militia. So now he's got about 1,000 men, a little more, to oppose the 1,700 men that are at the fort. Now, Arnold needs to use caution because the main objective is to relieve the fort. But if he waits too long, that means that the fort is in trouble. But if he waits a little bit longer, hopefully he'll get more support from the county militia. So he's in a weird impasse. He wants to get to the fort very quickly, so he brings their relief, but he needs more men. So he makes the call and says, on the morning of the 23rd, we're going to march for the fort, no matter how many men we have, and that's what we're going to do. So then, as they're nearing the fort, the British are gone. How could this be? What happened? What makes the British Army leave? Well, the story is probably one of the most unbelievable and fantastic tales that you'll ever hear during the American Revolution. See, Benedict Arnold is blood and guts. He's charged forward. Let's take it to the enemy. This time, he uses some cunning. He employs counterintelligence. You see, there's a man named Hans-Josef Schuyler, not related to the Schuyler in Albany. He's a German, and he lives in the area, and he's actually sentenced to death for recruiting men to the British cause. Arnold told him, I'll do you a favor. I'll pardon you if you do me this favor. Go to the British camp, spread word that a relief column is coming in overwhelming numbers. This plan was suspect for some because they felt that Hans-Josef was thought to be a half-idiot. However, the Indians had always regarded those that were thought to be insane with respect. Hans-Josef isn't a half-idiot. See, he's just as cunning as, he's probably one of the more cunning men in the area because he's playing a part. And what he does is he takes off his coat, he shoots a couple of bullet holes in it, and he and an Oneida man take off to the British position. Hans-Josef walked into the Indian camp alone, and, the Oneida man is off to the side. He kind of wanders into the camp on his own, and the Oneida man kind of finds his way in the background. And Hans-Josef, goes up to his Indian brethren, or at least that's how he said it, and he brings the warning that Arnold was coming with over 3,000 men. He wanted to warn his red brothers, and he showed them his coat as proof that, I was shot at by the Americans. At this time, the Oneida assistant came in and said, "Oh, his story is true. I saw the whole thing." And so now this panic has swept across the camp. And 200 Indians ran off in this riotous form. They were stealing liquor and supplies and anything else they can carry and just take off into the woods. Well, St. Ledger was hoping that he could meet with the war chiefs and quell, this panic. And he could hopefully implore them to stay and help the British commander. But no matter what he said, the Indians were planning to leave and they wanted out before the Americans arrived. So in a sense, the biggest, threat to the Americans and, his most, powerful force that he had at his disposal is just gone. So St. Ledger no matter how many men Arnold is bringing, whether it's 3,000, or 300. If he stays in this position without his Indians, he's at a disadvantage because it's 300 more men that Arnold is bringing. And, at this point, Arnold's legend is pretty well renowned across the American colonies. And it's only going to get bigger. On top of that, the fort has, several hundred men in there as well. So if Arnold arrives at the head of a column of men, and the fort sorties out, he's going to be stuck. And he's only got 800 men at this point. He's got, the regulars and whatever Tories are left. His Indians completely gone. So St. Ledger has to abandon the siege. He has no choice but to retreat, and he heads back to Oswego. They left everything. And when Arnold arrived, the fort he arrives to cheers and cannon fire from the fort, just praising their gratitude for his arrival and having, you know, been able to chase off the British without even firing a shot. Now, whether the story that Han Yost told was true or not, we may never know, but the Second Army of Burgoyne's attack was turned back, and that is something that we are positive of. Burgoyne was going to have to continue on his own. You see, remember, we were talking about this three-prong attack plan that he had. The first, him coming down from the north. We would have St. Leger coming from the west, going down the Mohawk Valley. And then he wanted Howe to join him from moving up from New York and pushing through the Hudson Highlands all the way up to Albany. And the three, you know, arms of this three-prong attack would meet in Albany. Well, we already know that Howe in the early summer said, no, my plan is to take the American capital in Philadelphia. And that's what he does. And that's going to be the next story arc we talk about after we finish the Saratoga campaign, is what is Howe doing? You know, he's down in, in the Mid-Atlantic air region of the colonies, chasing Washington around. So Burgoyne's mission and the fate of the rebellion are going to be decided in one place, Saratoga. That's going to do it for this week. And, this was another longer episode, but it was an episode that was definitely important because it now has shed light on our second turning point of the American Revolution. You see, the first one we said was Bennington. There's a group of people out there that say Bennington is the turning point because it weakened Burgoyne's army. Now we're seeing that this is the turning point because the second arm of Burgoyne's three-prong attack is gone. And then others say that Saratoga will be, and we're going to talk about the battles of Saratoga, and that's going to be something that we're going to have to decide later on, because whoever is the deciding factor of which battle is the turning point of the American Revolution is then going to be pitted against Valley Forge as the turning point for the American Revolution. And we're going to have to see what the people out in our little podcast universe say about it. Now, I did get some questions a while back. I did say that we were going to get to it. And, you know, I know I've taken a long break to concentrate on my child being born, which is probably going to happen any day now, and also my school studies because I'm finishing my master's degree. But we are getting there, and next week's episode is going to be the Danbury Raid and a couple of other events that will happen right before Saratoga that really they're contributing factors as to what happens at Saratoga and why it happens the way it does. And so that's something that we're going to look at next week. Next week is definitely a shorter episode. I know I've always been this man that said, 20-minute episodes, people, 20-minute episodes, but we're definitely going to be expanding this topic that we're talking about. So it's definitely going to be another longer episode, but having worked at Saratoga and being a student of this campaign, I'll tell you right now that I would have a lot of angry rangers and mentors calling me saying, you totally did not cover this properly. If I did not do my due diligence and talk about the some of the key battles of the American the key points of these battles for during the American Revolution. So that's going to do it for this week. As always, I would like to leave us off on another book recommendation. And the one that I have for this week is actually an interesting one. And it's called Decision on the Hudson. This book was also written by John Luzader, the man that wrote Saratoga, which was the book I recommended in our last episode. I feel like I may have given you the wrong first name, but both Decision on the Hudson and Saratoga were both written by John Luzader. He does very good job presenting a story of the overall campaign in Saratoga. But what Decision on the Hudson is this comprehensive, almost military guide of the battle itself. And both were very useful in my study for working at the battlefield. So they were both good reads. It just depends on how the style that you prefer. Do you like a more, you know, storied version, or do you like the more concise and numbers, military tactics, things like that? But both are very good reads if you're the you're into this battle. Okay, so that's going to do it for this week. As always, have a great weekend or a great week, and keep that powder dry.